to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is now episode number 509. And I'm back here recording with Dr. Lane Tipton, who serves as the pastor of Trinity OPC in Easton, Pennsylvania. And he teaches biblical and systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Welcome back, Lane. It's great to speak with you.
Thanks, Camden. It's great to be here.
Yeah, today we're going to be talking again about Voss's Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. That means it's Voss Group once again. We're going to be diving into the book and talking about the wonderful themes and the writing that Voss lays out for us here. We're going to be speaking specifically about the stages of the sacrificial ritual, hopefully going to be working through pages 161 through 165 in the Banner of Truth edition. But before we open that up and get into our subject today, got a few things to mention. Of course, Christ the Center is listener supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our programs, not only Christ the Center, but also Theology Simply Profound, Reformed Media Review, all of our other programs that we're working on. We love getting these resources out there and making them available and helpful to people around the world. And the downloads keep increasing. More and more people keep finding us and taking advantage of the resources that we've been able to put out. But we need your help so that we can continue doing this. And so if you visit us online at reformedforum.org, we have a donate page right there at the top. There's a link. You can click on that. And we'd very much encourage you to visit us there and pledge your support if you're able and willing to help us in our mission to promote Reformed theology, specifically in the traditions of Gerhardus Voss and Cornelius Van Til and Herman Ritterboss and many other people that we certainly owe a debt to theologically. While you're on the website, I encourage you also to find other ways to support us, not only by donating, which is critical and important, but we do also have an online store. We see this not necessarily as first and foremost a way to make a profit, but rather as a service. To our listeners and people who are interested in the things that we're interested in here at Reformed Forum. So we do have merchandise. Many of our listeners really enjoy getting hats or pint glasses, coffee mugs, various things with the Reformed Forum logo on there. You know, I have plenty of stuff myself. We're excited to make those things available, but we also now have a certain select used books in addition to our book, No Uncertain Sound. But Lane, last week we put up our Cracker Jack curator, Ryan Noah, found a first edition copy of Voss's Pauline Eschatology. A very clean copy, very nice hardcover first edition. And we put that in the store for $100, which actually is a deal considering what they often go for on the used book market. And sold within, I think I tweeted and tweeted about it and put it on Facebook. It sold within 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
So that's gone. Awesome. I don't mean to antagonize.
I was about to buy that, Camden. I am deeply disappointed now, but I'll try to recover.
I must say, we have many other things. A lot of books have been going, especially these first editions. We have signed copies of various resources. There's a lot of really cool stuff, and you got to keep your eyes open to the store because it goes fast. And right now we have a copy of Paul, An Outline of His Theology by Herman Ritterboss in the hardcover, good clean copy, $24, which is the deal on that. We have Van Til, a first edition of Van Til's book, The Theology of James Dane. We have some books by Murray. We have, I believe, some first edition copies of Van Til's Defense of the Faith coming soon. There's always things to look for. An R.B. Kuyper, To Be or Not to Be Reformed, first edition signed by the author. So there's a lot of cool stuff, and that's only $25, signed copy. So it's all online, reformedforum.org/store. You're going to find a bunch of really neat things. And keep coming back, because the inventory keeps changing more and more as Ryan finds some little treasures. We like to put them online and make reformedforum.org a kind of a one-stop shop for all things for our people. reformedforum.org. Thanks so much for all your support, both through donations and purchasing in the store, and for coming to our events. And we hope you will continue that up as we continue our working here to provide more and more Reform resources to our listeners. Well, Lane, now diving back into biblical theology here by Gerhardus Voss, I have a a paperback copy of the Banner of Truth edition before me, although we have a hardcover available online as well. You can order that. It's not signed. It was printed after Voss passed, but you can get a copy of that online as well. But turning here to page 161, we come to the stages of the sacrificial ritual. We're in the chapter still on the Old Testament and Revelation in the period of Moses. And what does Voss start to introduce here? We've been speaking before about Canaanite religion and culture. We've talked about the relationship between the offerer and his sacrifice. But now we come more specifically to the stages of the ritual. Why is this important to speak about these details?
Well, Voss is going to make explicit here that in order to understand the typology of Christ, you have to get clear on what the Bible teaches with regard to the stages of the sacrificial ritual, both with regard to the selection of the animal, the laying on of hands, or in Voss's observation, the leaning on of hands, and then the slaying of the animal. One of the reasons why this is important, beyond Voss's biblical theology and why it's germane for us, is that it's right here that Voss is going to give us some careful Old Testament reflection on the nature of the vicarious character of substitution and sacrifice rooted in the Old Testament itself. So rather than trying to say that the idea of vicarious sacrifice, of penal substitutionary sacrifice, is a later development either in the New Testament or in the history of the Christian tradition, Voss is going to try to show us, and I think he's very successful, that if you understand the stages of the sacrificial ritual, you're going to have to see these two things. You're going to have to see symbolism, which is going to turn in the direction of typology, but you also have to see vicariousness being presented. And so the first thing he deals with, he calls it the selection of the animal, and he talks about certain parameters and conditions that are in place with regard to age and condition. And the first thing that he notes there on page 161 is that the animal must be free from blemish that would detract its value as an offering in the place of a sinner. And so he raises this question, Camden, and I think this is an interesting question that I'm not sure we would raise without Voss's help. Here it is. He says, is this merely a symbolical view? And what does he mean by that? By a symbolical view, it would mean that the animal that is offered is intended to be a mirror image of the one who is offering that animal, so that the animal would be a pure symbolic or ideal presentation of the sinner himself. And it would be a kind of, if you want to put this in a broader context, it would be the liberalizing direction of the scholars that Voss is interacting with, who are quote-unquote modernist or liberal, who are going to be trending in the direction of denying vicarious substitutionary atonement and looking for some kind of ethical ideal to set before the church. So Voss is here interacting with what we would call, by and large, a liberal understanding of the stages of sacrificial ritual. And he says that we have to ask this question: how can a purely symbolic view hold that the perfect sacrifice, the sacrifice without blemish, represents the imperfect offerer as a mirror image? And he says, hey, there's a very easy answer to that. It can't. It does right. not. And so he says, instead of a symbolic view, he says we have to have a symbolic vicarious view. And here's what he's after. He's saying that through the perfection of another, namely an animal without blemish or defect, through the perfection, typical as it is, of another, something is accomplished that otherwise cannot be accomplished given the reality of sin. And I think that's a good observation, Camden. What don't you think? I think if we take a symbolic view where there's a kind of mirror imaging of the animal as the ideal representing in a kind of mirror image way the sinner, Voss is saying you're not going to be able to make sense of the fact that there's a vicarious dimension here, and the perfection of the animal is going to accomplish something by God's agency that would otherwise be impossible to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's pushing in this direction then, that there is in the animal a typological presentation of ethical purity. So that when you view an animal that is going to be offered without fault, without blemish, without defect, he says it's ethical purity that is going to be negative only. And that's over on the top of page 162. It's going to be negative only. And the reason why he's saying it is this. It's not really any kind of positive moral conformity to the law of God that the animal represents. It's rather of a negative sort, that this animal is free from blemish and free from defect, and as such can function as a type of one who is given in the place of another, who in itself does not have some kind of intrinsic moral defect. I think that's what Voss is after here. So he's saying that the animal exhibits, this is about the seventh or eighth line down, to be sure the animal exhibits ethical perfection after a very negative fashion only, in that it is not subject to moral distinctions, it is incapable of symbolizing moral defects. Now, I think what Voss is after there is that this is, in the nature of the case, a limitation of a type from the animal kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a type from the animal kingdom. And he says, and Camden, if you would you be able to read Isaiah 53:7 and then in conjunction with that, 1 Peter 1:19? Because Voss tries to pick up on the typical connection between the animal that is given and the blood offering of Christ fashioned after or patterned after that type.
Well, Isaiah 53:7 is, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. Then 1 Peter 1:19, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. To back up, we could back up. And if you call on him as Father who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot.
Yeah, see, and I think this is important, that you have in the Old Testament, from the prophetic horizon of Isaiah, you have the suffering servant being presented in a manner that is analogical to a lamb, a sacrificial lamb, quietly led to the slaughter, and presupposed in that is a lamb without defect. Peter, in 1 Peter 1:19, makes explicit that it is the without defect connection that supplies a type anti-type relationship. Just as the lamb, the sacrificial animal, was without defect, so also Christ in the shedding of his blood sheds blood that exhibits his moral perfection. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a discontinuity between the type and the anti-type.
By definition, yeah.
But I think Voss is on to a point here that in both Isaiah 53:7 and in 1 Peter 1:19, here's what we start to see, and this is what's important. You don't have a mere symbol or symbolical view of this lamb without defect, but you have a vicariousness coming into view.
Right.
Because especially in 1 Peter 1:19, why is Jesus shedding his blood? Mm-hmm. He's shedding it because of the impurity of those he has come to serve.
Well,
because
clearly,
of the sin. Yeah.
If it was a mere symbolical view, meaning that the sacrifice is supposed to be some symbolic duplication or clone of the sinner, and therefore symbolically must die because it is supposed to be the sinner, not just stand in for, but to be the sinner representatively, then you should not choose an animal that is without defect, but presumably because there needs to be a death to pay for the sin, you should exemplify or demonstrate that, that this clone would presumably be one with defect. I mean, to have a proper symbolical view, you would do the opposite of what the Lord commands them to do. What is being demonstrated is that there needs to be a typical perfect death to pay for your sins, to stand in for you if you are not to die for your own sins.
Yes, yes. And so what Voss says, that's very helpful, Cameron. What Voss is driving at here is that we are already being pushed in the direction of vicariousness. And the principle is this: through the perfection of another, something is accomplished for a sinner that cannot be accomplished by the sinner's own resources. That's where Voss is going. And so he says the second aspect of the ritual is the laying or leaning on of hands. And he uses Leviticus 16:21 as an example. Could you read that one also, Camden?
Yep, Leviticus 16:21, "And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the people of Israel and all their transgressions, all their sins. And he shall put them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a man who is in readiness."
Yes, yes. And so here Voss makes one comment when he's talking about the text from the standpoint of the analysis of the Hebrew. He's saying it's probably preferable to talk about a leaning on of hands. And I think what Voss is after is that there's that the contact that is made between the high priest and the scapegoat in this instance is a context by which, through the actual impressing of hands on an animal, there is a transfer of the sin and guilt of the offerer to the substitute, to the animal itself. And he's saying, you know, peculiar to the leaning on of hands then is a transfer for Israel as a nation, or the sinner as an individual, to the scapegoat. So there is in this ritual what we're going to see as absolutely intrinsic to the notion of a substitutionary, vicarious transaction, that there is a bona fide transfer of the guilt of sin from the sinner to the sin-bearing sacrifice. And so he's saying here, there must be a symbolic vicarious dimension here. You can't the I think maybe Voss would say this, it's intensively the case in the leaning on or laying on of hands that there is by divine design the transfer of sin and guilt from the sinner to a substitute. And Voss even goes on to say that, and I want us to point this out, that it's not merely that there's a transfer, but there is a bearing away into a place away from the altar presence of God. There's a transaction that occurs where the guilt of sin is transferred to a substitute, but that substitute, that scapegoat, is taken away from the presence of God at the altar.
It's a bad thing.
Well,
I've heard it was taught to me years ago that, you know, the one goat was slain to indicate that there needs to be a death, but the second goat was set free, indicate that we now are freed from the bonds of our sin. But it's the fact that this second goat is sent away is a bad thing. The second goat's indicating the expiation or the removal of our sin, and the sin now is as far from us as east is from west by the grace of God. But to be cast out of the camp, that is itself a death. It's a typological hell to be removed from the presence of God.
Yes, it's analogous to what the exile will be, right?
Exactly.
Being taken away from, driven away from the presence of God. It's very similar to what happens in Genesis 3, 21 and following, where Adam and Eve are cast out of the garden, east of Eden, away from the presence of God, and a flaming sword and the wrath associated with that flaming sword stands between the sinner and God. So I really do think here that the goat that is that becomes the scapegoat, like you're saying, it's not a picture of being set free from sin. It's still locked into the vicarious substitutionary work of bearing sin and taking it from the presence of God. So expiation is definitely there. Now, so Voss makes it clear, and we don't have time to probably deal with this as much as we could, but there's also an instance that Voss makes reference to in Genesis 48:13, where Israel lays a hand on Joseph, and I believe also Ephraim, and communicates blessing, so that there's a transfer of blessing from one to another, and that's also what is involved in a laying on of hands. But in this concrete instance, in Leviticus 16, it's very clearly that of vicarious sin bearing.
Yeah.
And
what are some liberal responses to that? Voss is clearly interacting and you know, at times polemic against liberal theology, and Machen, of course, about the same time as this, depends on when exactly Voss developed the material. I know when it was published, but I believe this was compiled from quite a few course notes and syllabi. But going on in the early 20th century and late 19th century, there is such liberalizing tendencies. We think of Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. How do the liberals deal with symbolism such as this, or with no notion perhaps of sin and the vicarious nature of it?
Yeah, I think A, they would take a purely symbolical view. B, I think they would say, in other words, they deny the vicariousness. B, they would say that this is a picture. If it's not a picture, if a liberal would not say it's a picture of being somehow set free from sin, I think the liberal would say it's actually a governmental or moral influence instance of quote-unquote atonement. Look how much God dislikes sin.
Yeah.
That he places it on another, and that person is then associated with sin. And what does it do? Well, it shows that you don't have the ethical purity to be in God's presence, to be in God's kingdom. So that to the extent that you take this in a symbolical way, you should learn to despise that sin that would send a goat out of the presence of God, just as Jesus' cross teaches you to despise that sin that would send Jesus to the cross. Not remember that the cross or this laying on of hands is an expiation of sin, not that there's a transfer of the guilt of sin. It's more like, take in this moral lesson of how abhorrent sin is, reflect on it, and as you reflect on it, grow to hate sin. It's you know, this negative reinforcement, as mm-hmm. it were. And let this influence you to have severe distaste for sin. And that would be in keeping, of course, with some kind of symbolical interpretation. It would deny vicariousness, and it would most certainly deny that there is sin being transferred to a substitute. That's the one thing that all liberal commentators, to the extent that they're truly liberal, they will deny that on principle, because they would say it's barbaric, superstitious, it's an earlier phase of evolution that hasn't reached the ideal of love and is still operating in these older penal substitutionary categories of the primitive culture.
And then we have others that would throw up their hands and argue that the Protestants just over-forensicized everything, and that with the Protestant mm-hmm. doctrine of justification, that this is merely importing categories that were unheard of to Paul. But this mm-hmm. just demonstrates, as Voss shows, that this is part of the entire sacrificial system, this notion of an exchange. And yes. the vicarious suffering and an imputation of sin and guilt and righteousness, all of these things are built in, and God has intended to demonstrate these through the typological kingdom, you know, and through to the nation of Israel. But now that Jesus Christ, the substance of the covenant, has come, these types and sacrifices have now yielded and passed away, because we have the once-for-all sacrifice that these were all meant to point forward to. But the Amen. Notion of a forensic or vicarious suffering and forensic notions of the transference of guilt and righteousness going both ways there, righteousness to us, guilt to Christ, this isn't foreign to the Old Testament.
No, it's not. And Voss makes an additional point that buttresses your excellent point on about third of the way down page 163. He says that there is also a goat who is sacrificed in bloody death, and its blood is sprinkled at the mercy seat, which brings into view what? The wages of sin is death, and without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. Romans 6:23, Hebrews 9:23 kind of converge there. But Voss makes this point, and I love it. He says, these two distinct goats function to form one sacrificial object.
Mm.
so that you get invisible form to the eyes of all who see the goat bearing away the guilt and sin of Israel, but you also get a sprinkling before the mercy seat in the presence of God, because it is only by the shedding of blood that sin is covered. It is only by the shedding of blood that wrath is propitiated. It is only by the shedding of blood, the blood of a substitute, that sin is expiated. And so Voss says, that means when you go to this third point about the slaying of the animal, and we've really almost said it all. I mean, we'll close this out, of course, but you could almost stop here. Voss says the previous view determines the meaning of the slaying of the animal. So what he's saying is the interpretation followed is of such great importance, because it virtually determines the construction to be placed upon the next following step in the ritual, the slaying of the animal by the hands of the offerer. And he says it is here that he discusses Mizbeach, the place of slaughter, where you've got an offering of a bloody sacrifice, mm-hmm. where it's so obvious that you don't have a purely symbolical portrayal here, because the slaying must be at the altar in the presence of God and in the midst of his just and holy wrath against sin. So he's saying, if you've understood what we've said up to this point about the nature of the animal being without blemish, the laying on of hands transferring guilt, and the fact that the scapegoat and the blood sacrifice in reality form one sacrificial object, then clearly the slaying and sacrifice being at the altar makes this clear. Death, as the wages of sin, is vicariously inflicted on a substitute in the presence of God, and it is blood that is the symbol of that transaction.
Right, but that death needs to occur as well. This slaughter is significant as well. Voss says, you know, both of these features tell strongly against a theory defended by even such safe interpreters as Kyle and Delitzsch, to the effect that the slaying of the animal forms no significant part of the ritual, but is simply the inevitable means for obtaining the blood and the fat. So it's just a means to an end in that view. They would say that the blood is significant, and it is. Blood is an important symbol of life, source of life. But the death also is very significant. Again, going back to that, the fact that this happens in the presence of the Lord, but the word itself, mitzbeach, the place of slaughter. It's not the place of blood obtainment.
Yes. That's very well said. And so, you know, the blood expiation.
Jesus wouldn't need to die per se. He could have merely have offered a transfusion.
You know? Yes.
So that, that's not satisfactory.
It's absurd. That's a great entailment. That's a great reductio, Dr. Busey, that blood expiates as it has passed through the crisis of death.
Yes.
And is therefore fit to be the exponent of death. So that, you know, you can't say that just any giving of blood expiates. It must be divinely ordained blood that is shed through the crisis of death with a view toward addressing the sin of the one represented. And so, you know, I was really surprised. I've got to tell you this, Camden. The first time I read it, and then when you read it again, I was really surprised of the oversight of Kyle and Delitzsch, that Voss caught them saying something that would lead in a direction that just wouldn't cohere. I mean, you're right. If they are correct, Kyle and Delitzsch are correct, you really don't need blood as an exponent of an expression of sacrificial death. You simply need blood.
Yeah.
Then Voss makes that distinction, Camden, that we probably want to point out on page 164, that for purposes of dogmatic precision, the first full paragraph, and that's a great thing to remember, that Voss, as biblical theologian, is always seeking dogmatic precision.
I'm working through his Reformed Dogmatics right now. I got a daily reading plan that helps me out, and he's superb. So those,
isn't he?
Yes, exactly. And I know many of you people have already read it. I'm working through it slowly in volume 2. But I encourage everyone to read, and reading about the conditionality or lack thereof in the covenant of grace is just some brilliant material that's ever applicable.
Wonderful material. Well, here he just reminds us of this, that we have to distinguish between the atonement itself, redemption accomplished, and the application of the atonement, redemption applied. And when we're talking about penal substitutionary atonement, he says we have to recognize that the symbolism of the ritual takes these two in one. When it says blood covers, and we'll talk about the covering next time, what it means for blood to cover sin. We'll look at that. It means to describe in one word the atonement viewed as vicarious, substitutionary, bearing away of the guilt of sin, plus the application of the atonement, which we call justification. Now, of course, Voss doesn't mean that the only application of atonement is justification. But in this instance, of course, what he does mean is that both features are invoked when your sin is covered. So there's a distinction, but integration of redemption accomplished and applied in this ritual. And I think that is a very helpful thing for us to remember, because it's not as though there was only the accomplishment of redemption without application, nor was there application that was not suspended on an antecedent accomplishment of redemption. But the two are so covenantally coordinated in this ritual that they are, in one way or another, distinguished for sure. But really, in a functional way toward Israel, inseparable in their efficacy. So the only thing there in Leviticus 17:11, I think the last thing to note is Voss says, you know, the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make covering for your souls. For it is the blood that makes covering by reason of the life. Really briefly, I think this is the simplest way to put this, that the soul, according to Voss, brings into view the conjunction of a life principle he calls the spirit in conjunction with the body. Soul and body are two aspects of talking about that immaterial dimension of human existence, and so it can serve as shorthand for the person in his or her totality. So here to say that I will make covering for your souls is a kind of, could we call it a Hebraism of sorts, a shorthand way of saying I have made covering for your person.
Or like some sort of metonymy.
Communion with me. Yeah, so a metonymy, where you've got a part making reference to the whole. I think that's what Voss is saying, and I think it should be – it's not some kind of Platonizing element. It's just a biblical way of talking about the totality of the whole person by focusing – on a specific aspect of the person, namely the soul. And then he has this great way of summarizing everything right at the very end of the paragraph, the last full paragraph on page 165. He says, when you're talking about what makes the principle of individuation and sensibility the proper instrument for expiation, he says this, and probably reading it and concluding with this is about as probably as well as we can do. He says, that which is a substitute for another person must be an individual, and that which undergoes punishment for another must be capable of feeling of suffering. You get that very imperfectly in the substitutionary lamb, in the animal sacrifice. Taking together, then, we must say this, that the blood has its rich symbolism in sacrifice, first, because it stands for death, secondly, because it stands for the death of an individual, substitutionary person, and thirdly, because it stands for a death involving suffering. All of this is given in the slaying. And so that to understand the typological significance of that slaying, all of those features have to be accounted for. And when those features are all accounted for, I think we can say this, that Voss helps us see in this ritual sacrifice a typico symbolic presentation of the gospel of God's Son in an earlier stage of redemptive history that's communicated through what Voss calls, and I think helpfully, the stages of the sacrificial ritual under the Mosaic economy.
Mm-hmm. No, I love the different stages here and the significance and how they point forward to the sacrifice of Christ. Of course, as a type is connected to the anti-type, so there is some similarity, but there are some significant differences. Obviously, goats, bulls, you know, any other animal that was sacrificed, they are not created in the image of God, and they are not moral beings or creatures. So in and of themselves have no ethical, moral qualities or righteousness themselves. But the fact that they're offering a sacrifice that is without blemish points forward to the perfect sacrifice of Jesus Christ, who is without blemish, but in a greater sense, because he is not guilty or sinful himself. Plus, he's perfectly God. So that's one connection there. But I think here, and to use a little bit of a sanctified imagination, or maybe perhaps to present kind of a wacky question that actually gets toward an important point, it's also, I believe, significant that God did not institute a resurrection of the goat. And I don't mean that in some form of blasphemous way, but just think that for a moment, that the goats died as a type of Christ to come. But the goat is, as a type, insufficient to atone for the sins once for all for the people.
Yes.
These are typical atonements, and they, by our means of grace, which do mediate the true substance of the covenant, the sacrifice, the grace of Jesus Christ. You know, we can look at the Westminster Confession of Faith 7:5 or 8:6 to speak about the sacramental nature of the sacrifice. There is a real connection by God's ordinance between the sacrifice offered typically and the sacrifice to come in Jesus Christ. But also the fact that these goats remain dead further underscores their insufficiency to atone truly. And I mean that in kind of the Johannine sense, that the not perfectly, because we need a greater sacrifice. And so this imagery comes to beautiful organic fruition with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, who not only is made in the image of God as we are, but now is the exact imprint of his character, who is the image of the invisible God, you know, Hebrews 1:1-3, Colossians 1:15 and following. But then the fact that when he dies, he offers a perfect sacrifice so that now death, it was not possible, according to Peter's inspired words in Acts 2, was not possible for him to remain in the grave. That Amen. This perfect sacrifice was raised from the dead and becomes life-giving spirit for us. So I love how this death is the death of these sacrifices is important and drives us forward, but also demands that there would be this perfect sacrifice to come, who not only dies for us, but also is raised for us, the once for all and only, you know, resurrection from the dead, he being then the first fruits of a greater harvest to come, as we will be raised from the dead too when our Lord returns.
Yeah, that, Ken, and what I love that you're bringing out is that that's not a kind of extrinsic imposition on what's being taught in the Pentateuch, according to Voss. It's an organic entailment. What you're saying is demanded, I think, by the theology that's already been supplied up to this point in the Pentateuch. And so, once again, the types are proleptic of Christ, but cannot contain all the fullness that is in Christ and give you these true but not yet consummately perfected points of data for getting the gospel. It's just not being brought to its fullness yet until Christ comes. So that's very helpful, and I continue to marvel at how much has been packed into biblical theology.
I know.
It's wonderful.
It's the greatest. Wonderful. Yeah, we love this book. I'm very thankful for God's servant, Gerhardus Voss, who's written this, Biblical Theology, Old and New Testaments. Again, keep your eyes online at reformedforum.org/store for earlier editions of this. We also have a brand new hardcover edition of the Banner of Truth copy that's available, and you can follow along if you don't have a copy already, or if you're looking to get one, perhaps for some loved ones or students, the seminary student in your life. There's a lot of great resources online, and we love working through this month by month as we have opportunity. So we do hope that you would visit us online at reformedforum.org. You can find all the episodes for previous Voss groups, as well as all of our previous 508 episodes of Christ the Center. Everything's available online. You can browse through, you can search, you can download them all free of charge. And we encourage you to stay in touch with us. You can, of course, send in your emails. You can tweet us. And we hope to see you at the conference if you're able to come. And if not, stay in touch and keep following along. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.